himself with a very fascinating question. It's a question that took place at the time of the NGL, and it's a question that that repeats itself in every. They didn't catch him. That repeats itself in every. This way you can follow along. You can come translating properly. What? Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I had a Rishosa, local Rishosa. So that in itself is a very fascinating question, both specifically what impact did the Egel have on the soul of Mishkan question, and as a paradigm in general for adjusting to catastrophes and to transforming events. I think it's really quite paradigmatic in many ways, and that's why certain things have to be repeated and reinforced, as I mentioned before. The Kiddush is that you can't go back, and the same plan does apply. And in other cases, it's the subtle changes that take place that really are striking, that stand out. Some of them, far should note, the different relationship between Shabbos and the Mishkan, pre and post Egel, right? The Shabbos appears in Parshas Kisisa, Shabbos appears in Parshas Vayakel. Kisisa appears after the Didim of the Mishkan are developed. Almost as an aftermath, Achas Shabsosai Tishmaru. In Vayakel, it's the beginning of the Parsha. Before you read anything about the Mishkan, Shabbos has to be formulated. And it's not Ach, it's clear. It's Losavaru H, Bechol Mashal Sechem, etc. Ramban is a comment which he says, the Makar for the Mishkan not violating Shabbos is not Ach as Shabsosai, which is what it seemed to be in Kisisa, but it is the clearer, more unambiguous, in other words, by Yakel, where Shabbos is mentioned before the Mishkan. Again, I think this could be symptomatic, as is the change in the Luchos themselves, and other things, points of emphasis. The Mishkan continues. Again, a lot of things are the same, but it's important that certain emphases change, so that we integrate the lessons of the Egel. That's a different era, and requires different emphatic emphasis. Okay, that's one of the main themes in these part of the Parshios. But finally, we reach Parshas Pikudei. That's the last rendition of the Mishkan, and we have a very fascinating pasuk here. Eilu Pikudei Mishkan, Mishkan Ha'edus Hashem Pukad Al Pi Moshe, Avodas Halevim, Yad Yisamar Ben Aaron HaKohen. First of all, this is presided over by apparently different levels of individuals. That's again another topic. And then we're told, Uvetzala ben Uri ben Hur l'mate Yehuda asa eis kalasha tziva Hashem es Moshe. That Betzalel, and we're given his whole background, he did asa eis kalasha tziva Hashem es Moshe. Everything that Moshe was commanded, Betzalel did. So Chazal were very sensitive to this. Hashem tziva osa Moshe ein ksiv kan. Not that Moshe commanded him, but rather Ela Kol Asher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. Apilu Dvarim Sha'Allah Amar Lo Rabo Hiskima Daito L'Mashanema L'Moshe Nisinai. So Rashi quotes this basically the Gemara in Brachos Daf Nun Hey that Bezalel did what Moshe was commanded from the Rabbanu Shalom, even the things that Moshe didn't command him directly. So the Yerushalmi, Torah Tzim, also I think quotes this Yerushalmi. It's very famous Yerushalmi in Peah, Perak Aleph, Halacha Aleph, where we read of several examples that are parallel to this. Yerushalmi says that Maisa Rabbi Shemav Sh'amad V'Hichlik Eskala Nechasim Laniim. Rabbi Shemav gave away all his money. So the Shalach Lor Rabbi Gamliel, Halo Amru Chomesh Menachasav LaMitzvah, but isn't it supposed to be limited to Chomesh? You don't just have to give away a fifth of your money, not just to give away everything, then become, you jeopardize your own financial status, and you end up not only going too far from your own perspective, but even from Klal Yisrael's perspective, because we don't want to have to support you as well. So the Gemara says, Yushami says, V'Rabbi Gamliel Lo Kodem Lu Shahaya. Wasn't Rabbi Gamliel before Usha, and wasn't it a Takanas Usha that established this limit of Chomish Bedama? So the Gemara says, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbum, the Shem Rabbi Levi, Kach Hoysa Halacha B'Yadam, Originally, this was the halacha. The shakachuha, and they forgot it. The amdu hashnayim v'hiskimu al das harishonim. The lamedcha shekol davar shebezin knows the nashon alav. Whenever Bezin puts in strenuous effort, hu miskayim. They were able to be miskaven, and they were able to fulfill that which was told all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu Nisina. Quite an ambitious statement. The Asya Kidama Rabbana. This is consistent with what Rabbana said. Kila Dama Reku Bakem, Mekem rather. The Imu Reik Mekem, right? Ulama. She'enaten Yigeim Batora Kihu Chayechem. If something is reik mikem, it's only because of your lack of yegiyah. Emasai hu chayechem. And when is it chayechem? Kishatem yegeim bo. Rab Tanchuma b'shem Rab Huda says, U'betzalo ben Uri ben Chur l'mate Yehuda asa eskola shatziva Hashem es Moshe. Eskola shatziva oso Moshe ein ksiv kan. Ela shatziva Hashem es Moshe. Afilu dvarim sheloshama mipirabo hiskimo daita kemoshenemar lemoshe misinai. Again, you have this idea. And then again, continues Rav Yochanan b'shem Rabbanai, kasha tziva Hashem es Moshe avdo, kein tziva Moshe es Yehoshua, v'chein osa Yehoshua, lo hisur davar mikalasha tziva Hashem es Moshe. Oso Moshe ein ksiv kan, ela mikalasha tziva Hashem es Moshe. Afilu dvarim sheloshama mipi Moshe, Hiskima Tamak Yoshua now, Hiskima Daita Kamashanema Lamosha Nisina. Okay. Rav Yochanan B'Shem Rabbanai, B'Shem Rav Yehuda, Emma Sais of the Pihu, Dvarm Shashama Mipirabo, the Avla Lonimsa Vesvasav, Afil Dvarm Shaloshama Mipirabo. So basically, the theme of this Rishalmi is clear, four or five different memoras, and that is that it's possible to divine, it's not a proper word, it looks like you're divining what was told to Moshe Rabbeinu, Misinai, with the proper amount of Yegiyah of Amal, in the case of Bezdin, or given the fact that you're a proper Talmud to begin with, in the case of Bezalel and Yehoshua. The very famous statement from Rabbi Eliezer, Gemara in Sukkah, in the end of the second parrot, Rabbi Elazar said that Me'olam lo amar davar shaloshama mipirabo. So he never said anything. He was never mechadish anything in halacha that he didn't hear from his rabbi. And again, it's known all the achorim speak about this. They all point out that if you look at Rabbi Eliezer's contribution, you know it's clear that there are many things that he added. And Abbas Rav Nosson, they're particularly complimentary of Rabbi Eliezer as being a mechadish. And that Rabbi Yochanan Rabbo, in particular, pointed out, called on him and said, you know, say some chidushim, you know, things that haven't been heard before. Clearly, this is part of the, you know, the dynamic of Rebbe and Talmud, that's expressed also in this Yerushalmi. Namely, there's no stira between the fact that he was Omer Dvarim Bechudashim, and that he at least had the self-image, maybe even the reality, of Me'olam La'amar Davar Shaloshama Mipi Rabo. The truth is that this idea, this connection, really is reflected in two different emphases in Chazal. One is this one in the Yerushalmi, which is that basically it seems clear, that the content that is later divined by the Talmud or by the Bezdin is something which was fully formulated by the Rebbe. And there, the remarkable phenomenon is the fact that without direct tradition, without a direct Mesorah, the Talmud was able to reconstruct this on his own. We also find a parallel opposite, but I think more parallel than opposite, and that of course is instances where chidushim, clear chidushim, are said by a Talmud, and the credit is given in some respect to the Rebbe. Kol Masha Talmud Vasik Asid Lachadesh Nema Lemoshe Misinai is understood at least by some, not that lock, stock, and barrel it was said by Moshe Rabbeinu, but that by you could trace its roots back to Moshe Rabbeinu, even though certainly what took place was a transformed Kiddush. And of course, that's the basis of the Gemara in the Machos, where the Gemara tells that famous story about Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Akiva, and Moshe Rabbeinu visiting the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Akiva and saying, I don't understand what he's saying, and becoming very depressed. And then the only thing that shook him from his depression, and didn't just shake him from depression, but it transformed his depression into exuberance, was the fact that in the end he overheard that when one of the Talmidim said to Rabbi Akiva, how do you know all of that? So Rabbi Akiva said, I learned all of that through the Sora that traces back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So it's clear that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't enthusiastic only because he got the credit. Had he been convinced that he didn't deserve the credit, then it would have been an empty gesture. When Rabbi Akiva credited Moshe Rabbeinu, then Moshe Rabbeinu understood. He was looking at it in a different light, from a different perspective. He then understood what the unfolding of the Masorah was. He was able to connect the dots, and then he understood that his contribution really was crucial, that what he said was the root and foundation of what Rabbi Akiva said. He then appreciated Rabbi Akiva more, and his confidence in the process of Masorah and Halakha was enhanced as well. So that Gemara Menachos is clearly a situation where Moshe Rabbeinu didn't say it lock, stock, and barrel. Kol Ma SheTalmud Basik Asa B'Chadesh probably is a situation like that as well. And yet, again, you have this connection. So we have it in both directions. We have the Talmud able to anticipate what the Rebbe would have said had he been there, or what really was told to the Rebbe historically, or what the Rebbe developed historically. And then we also have the Talmud's contributions, new contributions, being credited to the Rebbe, and not just to say an empty gesture, but apparently in a way that makes it significant, a way that is real. Apparently without that early root and foundation, the next stage couldn't have taken place. Moreover, apparently what the Talmud said was latent potential in what the Rebbe said. Maybe it didn't have to go in that direction. Maybe it could have developed in a different direction. But the fact is that you can connect the two dots in this case. Mentioned many times in other contexts that the Rebbe used to say about Reb Chaim that he was a revolutionary, and he writes about this a lot in Ishalacha and in Madodei Chemidon, Hesped for Avelvel, and used to speak about it a lot as well. At the same time, he would equally speak about the fact that people who argue that Reb Chaim, sprang up in a void and don't see that, there's a link between the Rishonim and the Xos and the Sivas and the Kedager and so on and so forth. And Reb Chaim don't understand anything about Talmud Torah. That's because both of these things can be true. And they can be true in both directions. In some cases, we deal with one expression or the other, and in most cases, there's a little bit of truth to both. In many cases, the Talmud looks like he's starting from scratch, doesn't have a specific Masorah, is able to reconstruct what takes place. At the same time, in the process of that reconstruction, and maybe even part of his ability to reconstruct is due to his innovative, personal understanding, which takes it that step further. So in many cases, both things take place at the same time. There's the Masha Talmud Basik Asa B'Chadesh, but it's still rooted in this Yerushalmi in Peya, this idea that there can be this kind of reconstruction. In some Makaros, one could argue that we're just talking about nothing more than the perception of the Talmud, that he is in the derech of his Rabbein. That would be significant enough. It tells us, what is important to him, assuming we're talking about men of stature, which in the case of Chazal, and Rishonim, and Akronim, we're always talking about men of stature. In other cases, like the Yerushalmi, we're talking about a reality. Again, the Gemara Tumura speaks in similar terms about Moshe Rabbeinu, B'nei Evlo Shel Moshe, all the halachos that were lost, until Asniel ben Knaz, Ekziram Bitok Pupulo. So again, it's this, the same idea. He was able to reconstruct what was, but he's given credit, Mitok Pilpulo, for doing it. And that's the Gemara in Tzmur Daf Yudalid that says explicitly that you know, they when this happened, so the, you know, the people came to Yehoshua, and they came to Shmuel, and they desperately pleaded with them, you know, to use their gift of nevuah in order to reconstruct the halachas. And that's where the Gemara says clearly, lo b'shamayim hi, and ein davi rasha yelechadish davar meyata, you know, ad sheh, ba asniel ben knaz v'chsirim b'toch pulpulo, which means that it is reconstructible, but only through the yigiyah, like Yerushalmi says, only through the hard work of Talmud Torah, is it reconstructible. So we're dealing with more than a perception, which would be important in its own right, but with the reality. How does this take place? So clearly, it takes place through methodology and the development of an instinct. Now, the methodology part is the purely rational part, which is clear. Bitzalah was around the Moshe Rabbeinu long enough, so he started to develop an understanding of the way that he thought. Moshe Rabbeinu was an excellent pedagogue. That's why we call him Rabbeinu. Apparently, he was the pedagogue of Klal Yisrael. So, understanding how to reconstruct in his methodology is something that a good Talmud like Bitzalah, a dedicated Talmud, or like Yehoshua, was able to accomplish. But it also means developing an instinct. And in that sense, that's reflected by the continuation of the Gemara in Brachos, which Rashi quotes here. Bitzel Kael Hayisa. Moshe Rabbeinu turned to Bitzalel, and he said, Bitzel Kael Hayisa. That you were in the shadow, it's as if you were there when the conversation took place, number one. But it obviously doesn't just mean that particular conversation, it means you've developed Bitzel Kael. You've developed a halakhic instinct, an intuition, how to interpret sources, how to proceed, you know, with little information, what directions seem to be acceptable, plausible, you know, what are dead ends, inappropriate perspectives, and so on. So there's the methodology, which is purely rational, albeit requiring yigiyah, and then there's also this development of intuition and instinct. But in addition to that, there always has to be that self-image and perception of a being a Talmud of a Rebbe. Again, it's Bitzel Kael Ha'isa, but still formulated in the Torah as Eis Kol Asher Tziva Hashem Es Moshe. Bitzalah reconstructs it through his connection to Moshe Rabbeinu, albeit he's able to be miskaven to what the Rabbeinu Sholem said, not just to what Moshe Rabbeinu said. That itself is important. When we speak about the concept of Dmus Dyukno Shel Abba Abba, so of course Chazal developed it with regard to Yosef in the context of Chet, you know, to put the brakes on doing something wrong, Sur Meira. But clearly this idea also has its positive expression. Eilat Toldos Yitzchak Ben Avram, Avram Holiness Yitzchak, right? Yitzchak's whole life is an effort to emulate what took place to Avram Avinu. In that case, the identification is largely one of perception and less so of reality. Because he behaves like Avraham Avinu, even though his personality and his circumstances are so radically different. So you have the Be'eros, and you have the, you know, Achosihi story, and other such things. And yet, his whole life and the midos that he accentuates and develops are completely different. So there's a perception of total identification. The Chazal say that Yitzchak looked exactly like Abraham, symbolic as well. There's also the reality in terms of his behavior and in terms of what he gains, but his destiny is supposed to be different. But that's a Dmus Dyukno Shel Abba, which is carved into his very personality. But Dmus Dyukno Shel Abba, I say, refers clearly to inspiration, methodology, and the development of an instinct as well. The Gemara Brachos Daf Nun Hei, though, goes a step further in all of this. That's what Rashi quotes here in the beginning of the Kudei. They develop this idea, Adfil Dvarim Shela Amar La Rabo Eskima Daita L'ma Shenemar L'Moshe V'Sinai. So then the story as it's developed is, Ki Moshe Tziva L'Bitzala L'Asos Tchila Kelim V'Achakach Mishka. And then, in many Rashis, I see this one they have also, they start wondering whether this is true or not. Did Moshe ever command Bitzalel to make the Caleb before the Mishkan. Lolinyan Sibu Lisnadev Kalmar. The Adarab al Hefer. Siva Kadish Barku, the Parshas Truma, Shivitzchila Kalim Shulchan Nor Yerios. Achakach Sibui Akroshin. Siva Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Shalom, Reish Vayakel, Tchilas Amishkan Baalav Achakach Kalim. Elamir Linyan Sibui Lefoel, Ech Gifol Haseder. The Timotzev Parshas Kisisa, and so on. This is Bali Tosis and Brachos, and some of the Achronim, and some of the Mefarshim Al HaTorah deal with this extensively. Is it really true that Moshe Rabbeinu was pushing a program of Aron and Kalim before Mishkan, or not? Or, it's like I said when I began, the fascinating thing about the Mishkan is that the change in emphasis, and in some cases in order. Ki'ilu, the Torah is telling us, you can look at the Mishkan this way, you can look at it that way, you can look at it a third way. All these perspectives are important. In some cases, the theoretical emphasizes one, the practical the other, the before the angle one, the after angle the other, and so on. This is an example of what's going on in this discussion of Moshe and Bezalel as well. So the ultimately, though, the Gemara does record that there was this debate. And Amar lo Bezalel, or Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to have this plan. Amar lo Bezalel, binag ha'olam la'asas t'chila bayis, achach meisim kelim b'talcha. Amar lo, kach shamati b'pi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Amar lo, Moshe, Bezalel kel ha'yisa. Ki bevadai kach tzivol ya HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'chein asa, ha'mishkan t'chila, v'achach ha'kel. So basically, with this Maimar Chazal in Brachos adds, is that not only does the Talmud have the ability to reconstruct the Rebbe's thinking, ki'ilu shama mimenu, or as if, you know, these are perhaps two different things. Ki'ilu shama mimenu in some cases, ki'ilu shama when the Rebbe learned it, even from the Rebbe Shalom. But in some cases, he has the ability to reconstruct better than the source. That, of course, is an amazing extension. So some of the Mefarshim are not happy about this amazing extension. And for example, the Medrash Rabbah in Shemos has a different version of the story in which everything is turned around. Basically, Bezalel is the one who is interested in making the Aron before the Mishkan. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, you can't do that. Didn't you hear the Shir? And this is exactly what the Rebbe Shalom said to me, that you have to make the Mishkan first. And then you make the Kalim, including the Aron. So in the contrary, in the version of the Medrash, it becomes a testimonial to the more precise, more accurate Mesorah of the Rebbe over that of the Talmud. But according to the Gemara Brachos, it really is very striking. So in a way, some of the Mefarshim tried to contend with that as well. The Kliyakar, for example, suggests that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't really going to proceed and build the Aron for the Mishkan, after all, the Rebbe Shalom told him something and he understood it, and so he understood it better than Bezalel. This was kind of a test for Bezalel. Taz says it's also in his Perush on Rashi, the Divrei David. It was kind of a test for the for the young, upcoming Bezalel. Moshe Rabbeinu told him a bunch of facts. Each time in the Torah, the formulations are different. Right, in Truma, and in Vayakel, and in Kisisa, and now in Pekudei, the order keeps changing, and he wanted to see what's, young Bezalel going to do with all of this. And, he was kind of playing devil's advocate, maybe saying, really? I mean, do you think you should really build that bias before the Aron? Isn't the Aron the ultimate purpose of the Mishkan? And Bezalel gave him the right answer. Bezalel said, no, master. The fact is that, Minhag HaOlam is this way, and that's Koveya in this particular case, not the value of the Kalim versus the bias, but the mechanism. The bias can only help the Kalim if it's pursued in a certain way. So basically, this was the test that Bezalel passed with flying colors. Bezalel Kel Ha'isa. But Chas V'Shalom, did he, did he know Moshe Rabbeinu's mind better than Moshe Rabbeinu's mind, or the Rebbeinu Shalom's communication better than Moshe, or the Rebbeinu Shalom's communication to Moshe better than Moshe? The truth is, that's all very, very good and fascinating. But the simple reading of the Gemara Brachos is not that way. And when Rashi quotes it, he definitely doesn't present it that way. And again, when Bali Tosis and some of the other Mepharshim in Brachos scrambled to try to figure out when did Moshe say this and when did Bezalel say that, they take the Gemara quite literally. Frankly, I think that one can make a strong case that it's more inspiring, not less inspiring, to read the Gemara Kipshuta, because it really bespeaks not of a competition between Rebbe and Talmud, where the Talmud trumps the Rebbe. That could happen too. In the pursuit for Amita Shel Torah, sometimes the Talmud has the right to argue with the Rebbe and to overcome his objections. We discussed that a lot. Those who were here last year, we talked about when you can be Mora Harol if they Rabo, La Frushe Misura. There are limits, and there are also licenses under certain conditions. But I think even more so, the real point of this Gemara isn't that the Talmud was more insightful than the Rebbe, but that the Rebbe-Talmud relationship was, and the impact of the Rebbe and the Talmud was so powerful that he was able to, to internalize it became almost second nature, instinctive to him, how the Rebbe thinks. And it ultimately was the greatest testimonial, to Moshe Rabbeinu, that Bezalel Ke Eloisa, could have understood initially, even better than Moshe, what the Rebbeinu Shalom wanted from him. I think it really is a very powerful powerful statement. And in this sense, Yahdus really is unique. If you compare the Rebbe-Talmud relationship with that of an academic relationship, for example, and of course there are exceptions to all rules, but if you ever read anything about the academic world, biographies and autobiographies even more so, the cutthroat relationship that sometimes exists between academicians and their mentors, the harrowing experiences of pursuing graduate degrees, in some cases, again, there are obviously exceptions to all rules, but this very strong competitive relationship, and sometimes the student feels this almost choked by his mentor, and held back by him, the need to liberate oneself and to find your own niche. It's a very big theme in academic life. In Torah life, there are also exceptions for every rule, and not every Rebbe-Talmud relationship develops as it should. But at least the halakhic norm, and I think in practice the norm as well, is based on that very famous Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Lamed. Initially, in the process of studying, so it's Milchamta Shel Torah, in every sense. Menasim Oyvin Zeh, in the pursuit for the truth of Torah. There are certain even niceties that sometimes get left behind. But Sof-Sof, Eim Zazim Micham, Achinasim Ohavim Zeh Zeh, and it's really meant to be, and hopefully often is, or the Shinanta Levanecha Elu Talmidecha, type of relationship. It's meant to be an ongoing, a lifelong relationship, not the kind of thing, you get your PhD and you don't want to ever see him again. Again, there are exceptions to all rules, and I'm certainly not talking about my own experience, which is very fine and very good. But I dealt with people who were Talmid Chachamim, so also a little bit different. But again, this it's almost the exact opposite. You have to work with the person and mollify him and make sure you don't step on his toes too much and impinge upon his ego too much. And then once you have what you came for, you really want to, as I say, carve your own niche and blaze your own trail and so on. And in Torah, it's exactly, as I say, the opposite. There's a pursuit of truth which allows for the breaking of certain boundaries. And at the same time, there's this ongoing and lifelong relationship that's supposed to continue as well. A Rebbe who holds back from his Talmidim is compared to a Nabi who is Kovesh and Nevuaso. And Talmud who's Cholek al Rabo, in terms of really challenging his basic authority, not in the case of Afrusha Yisura, but in other such matters, doesn't show the proper relationship, is kecholek al hashchina. And it's meant to continue that way know, indefinitely in a productive relationship. A kol miskanim chutz mibno tamido. Again, it doesn't always work. Everybody knows exceptions to the rule. People are human, and even Talmidei Chachamim are human and sometimes don't live up to the lofty standards that the halakha wants for them. But at least it's usually the norm, and it's definitely, let's say, on the books, the halakhic norm. People are supposed to suppress their ego when it comes to their, you know, their children and their Talmidim. And if the relationship is one where, you know, the Talmud really gains that much from the Rebbe, B'tzeil Kael Ha'isa, and so on, then it doesn't even require so much of a suppression of ego. If you profoundly understand it, then the Rebbe understands that, you know, his stature and his position is not being jeopardized, even when there appears to be, you know, disagreement, because in the end it's a tribute to him, and, you know, he's credited. Not that he needs the credit, but he feels that it's part of his own internal development. We say about a Talmud Chacham, "Shas Hisosov Dov Bas Bekevra." This is really what it means. His Torah and his methodology and his instinct and his intuition that he developed, you know, from his Rabbeim and they from theirs, all through that chain of the Masorah, get continued with his children and his Talmidim, his spiritual children, and Sifsosov Domos Bekever. When you're sitting in a Gemara or Rambam or Yerushalmi, and you say, you know, what would the Rebbe have said, even when he's no longer there? And you remember, you know, how he sounded, you know, might make fun of his accent a little bit, but, you know, in a loving kind of way. So, you know, it brings things back to you and sometimes opens a door for you. Then that's the Sosam Domus Bekever. Whether you're accurate or not, you know, it depends how good a Talmud you are. But in terms of your self-image, at least, what it is that you're doing, and in terms of the ongoing relationship that you have, even with someone who's no longer there, in that sense, it's Sosam Domus Bekever. That person continues to be a part of the discussion, continues to dominate the discussion at many times. You know, would the Rebbe have thrown that svara out? You know, would he have made a face, or would he have embraced it? Sometimes it makes all the difference in the world in your own pursuits. And this has impact on the issue of Omer Davar B'Shem Omro, maybe Geula Leolam as well. It's certainly the norm, and people should be as careful about it as they can, especially in things that are singular. You know, some things that are obvious, and everybody says them. And, the Rebbe may have said it, and you may have said it, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be quoted. Sometimes when you quote certain things, it's, you know, it's overkill. It detracts from stature because, as I say, if it's a universal idea, and so on, this doesn't require that kind of approach. But things that are singular, that are different, I don't know if they have to be completely unique, but, or there's a nofech mishalo. So we do say Omer Davar B'Shem Omro Vevi Gula Liyala, and there is a kind of a intellectual property notion in Yahdus from that point of view, in terms of giving credit, at least. At the same time, there's no notion of intellectual property that, you know, doesn't allow one, you know, to use the Rebbe's chiddush without his permission. Maybe, you know, you might want to check with him whether you're quoting it accurately, or if it's a matter of sensitivity or controversy, whether or not he's makbid that, you know, the masses know about this, that's a different point. But in terms of the, you know, those issues aside, there's no notion of intellectual property. You can't quote his explanation of the Rambam unless he allows you to, because he wants to write a paper on the topic. At least as far as I know, there's no such thing. At the same time, because of some of the factors, you know, that I tried to just describe, this is abused, or it isn't abused because it just sometimes naturally falls by the wayside. Sometimes there's a lot of unconscious borrowing between Talmidim and the Rabbeim. You heard something, and it made a tremendous impression on you, but don't necessarily know, it's so natural, you received so much, and this now becomes so central, this idea in your life, or your understanding of a topic, that you thought you came up with it on your own, or you thought that everybody says it. And it happens to be the singular chiddush of a particular person, but you're just not aware of it. Clearly, in such a situation, you're blameless when you don't quote. Or you've developed a certain instinct and intuition, and even more than that, earlier, the methodology, therefore you have a way of thinking and a way of handling problems and developing topics. And you come up with, you know, with the same idea that, that someone else came up with. Again, you know, just, in the world of Brisk, for example, if anybody were ever to try historically to figure out who said what, you would have an enormous task on his hands. Even in my tenure in the Rav Shir, so there were plenty of things I heard from the Rav, which later I saw were Rav Chaim, or that he said in the name of his father, which it turned out to be Rav Chaim. The relationship between Rav Chaim and between Moshe and Rav Albo is a particularly complex one. The American side of the family says that, you know, good chunks of what's known as Rav Albo's Torah is really the older brother's Torah. Not in competition, just a question of, you know, everybody learned in the same Beis Medrash, they had a certain, you know, derech halimud. Some things, you know, just became so ingrained that, you know, they thought it, you know, came back, went all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, or, you know, or at least to the Rambam, not to Rav Chaim, but, you know, in other cases, you know, they thought they came onto it on their own. Again, I've seen in my own case also certain things that sometimes I think I've made up, and it turns out that that it's not so. It's something that I heard from someone else, or sometimes I develop something that I think is unique, and someone else has developed it. And sometimes I develop things that are wrong, and I just try to take the credit for that on my own. But the point is that it's this whole question of intellectual property is a difficult question in Torah Halacha. One should try to give credit, but at the same time, there are reasons sometimes that credit isn't given that are not intentional, but have to do, ironically, with the closeness of this Rebbe-Talmud relationship. Bezalel gave credit to Moshe Rabbeinu, but it could have been otherwise. You know, he just might have been Bezalel Kael, but not necessarily, you know, when Rabbeinu Shalom told it to Moshe Rabbeinu. He just might have developed on his own an instinct to understand it was right or was wrong, but not credit Moshe Rabbeinu. And if that had been done in a context of sincerity, then there would be no blame. There would be nothing wrong with that. In a way, as I say, it would be the ultimate testimonial to the influence of Moshe Rabbeinu. So as we wrap up Parshas Pekudei and the building of the Mishkan, it's just all of its repetition and nuances and formulations, etc. I think it's particularly apt to focus in on this question, because Torah can be very complex, and there are really a lot of subtleties to mine, and one needs to appreciate that while one is obligated to do so to the best of one's ability, that the capacity that you develop to do so is really something that stands in a long-standing Torah. That even as credit should be given on the one hand, at the same time, the ultimate credit is the yigia, as the Rishami says itself, and the results of reconstruction that come therefrom. Yeah.
Sorry, is there a difference between the tradition of Talmud in the Aldeis and the way it was back then? I mean, I know that the Gemara Kula, when it refers to Chumash,
back then, meaning
time
of Bezalel and Moshe Rabbeinu.
We have the Gemara uses the word Chidush, and you know, the impression that it got was that it's something that I heard from somebody, but just it wasn't heard in that letters yet, so it was a chiddush. Nowadays, a chiddush means coming up with an interpretation of Mara or Rishon or something like that.
I'm not sure I agree with your first point. I'm not sure why you think with the Gemara, aim based on Medrash, no chiddush always means something that this particular base of Medrash hasn't heard. It's a simple shot of the Gemara, and it's aim based on Medrash, no chiddush means that people are studying seriously and putting in effort, intellectual and spiritual, that they'll come up with things. Other Gemaras also would speak about Shara Chadash, other things. It sounds like, even in the time of the Gemara, there were Chidushim. Sometimes Chidushim are just an application. Sometimes Chidushim are just a nuance or an added dimension of formulation. And I think that there are plenty of Gemaras that indicate that Chiddush is a Chiddush. I think there are many times today also where Chiddushim are just bringing something to an audience that doesn't know of it. It could be that if you studied this scientifically and rigorously, you might come to the conclusion that more often than not, Chiddush means one thing in one culture and something else in another culture. But I think there are enough overlaps in both directions that it's interesting historically, but it's not really important normatively. So, yeah.
Sometimes it seems inappropriate for someone to say, you know, I know what everyone has said in this situation.
Right.
So is there anything, what are the limits of the incumbent already's perspective and,
it's a very, very good question. I mean, it's very Lemaisa too, because people often say things and blame people. And one Talmud says it, and then the other Talmud is horrified. So, right. I think there's a difference between pronouncing it and it shaping your own thinking. In other words, again, this self-image that you're a Talmud of a Rebbe, and what would the Rebbe have said? You know, trying to picture what he would have said. Again, I don't mean it in a mystical way. I mean it in a very logical, but also spiritual way. I think that's very important. And this idea of Dmus Yukno, Shal Abba, Shal Rebbe, is important before you do anything, which has consequences, what you think. You know, how would it have been done? What would he have said? If I could ask advice, what do I think? But, a person has to know that he's only speculating. And, humility is the first line of defense, against making mistakes. And it's also a critical component of Talmud Torah in its own right. So first you have to know that you're speculating, and that, especially if you have a great regard for your Rebbeim, as much as you think you may know them, you have to acknowledge, to yourself at least, that maybe it's unreachable. So you try, you don't say it's unreachable, and therefore I'll just, walk in ignorance, or I'll speculate, or I'll guess. You do the best of your ability, but your personal humility and your own awareness of speculation, therefore your own skepticism about what you're doing, is very important. I think it would take a lot, for you to say to a public, this is what the Rebbe would have said had he been there. I think there can be two exceptions, and three exceptions. One is, if it's not such a weighty matter, ironically, it doesn't. If I, I'm giving a shiur and I say, the Rav would have hated that svara, milsud dibdi chusa, or even if I mean it, that's not really. I wouldn't call that presumptuous. The stakes aren't that high, and it's an opinion, and everybody understands it that way, and so on. So it's a compliment, and it's honest, but I say it's not a weighty pronouncement, and I don't have kamina. And, if somebody says, I don't think so, fine. I think the other, two exceptions are the other direction. And one is, when you really feel very strongly by not saying it, somehow the legacy of Torah or the legacy of your Rebbeim are tarnished. So, basically you have to make a difficult choice, whether to risk this speculation and the presumptuousness, but, for their sake, in a way. I mean, you're a Talmud of a certain Rebbe, and things are being said in his name, or done, justified on his on his back. And you want to make it clear that you think that this is absolutely, horrific. So then sometimes, being a tzaddik and being an anav and saying this is what I think, but it has nothing to do with him, can be counterproductive, because you really feel passionately that this is tarnishing his... And of course, the second aspect of that, which is the third point, is you have to really feel certainty. And you have to be in a position where your certainty is relevant. In other words, if I'm basically a mediocre Talmud, but I feel strongly about something, but I also know that I'm a mediocre Talmud, so sharing, saying I feel certain the Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Abaya, Rava, I feel certain this is what they would have said, it could be the true conviction of my heart, and still it would be presumptuous, obviously. But with all one's humility, if one really does feel that he's competent and that he really is, a faithful transmitter of a certain school or of a certain, whether it's a Baya again or a Moshe Feinstein or whoever, he feels really strongly about it, and the issue is an important one. So giving it the weight of saying, I feel certain this is what the Rebbe would have said, and to couple with the certainty coupled with the competence, under those conditions, I think, it's legitimate. But I think people do it much too often. I basically find myself in agreement with you. In terms of pronouncements, what would X have said about this? What would Y have said about that? I think that mostly what people should say, even the people who do feel strongly, unless you know, we're talking about the issues that I just brought up, is, you know, I feel strongly about this for the following reasons, the substance. Also, as one who was trained in a certain derech, that's the next step, as one who was trained in a certain derech, you know, I can't know, you know, what the person or the derech, you know, would have conveyed, but, you know, I feel strongly, you know, that this is inconsistent, you know, with that. And I think in 95% of the cases, that would be sufficient. And you know, let's just so dovos bekever, apply the cases that are more either more obvious or less controversial, unless it becomes necessary for Klal Yisrael or for the person's reputation, and even then, with those conditions. Okay. Yeah. I like to quote that. I like the reinterpret a little bit the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Like Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Tess and Aleph makes a distinction between Girsa and Shmaita, something like that. So basically, what I think that means is that there should be a balance between exposure and primary methodology. I think it's good to have many exposures. Be exposed to many great people and get different things from them. You know, some people are great in analysis, and other people are, you know, can teach you how to read, and other people, you know, just have an uncanny instinct, and just watching them, you know, getting to feel what they do, you know, it can be invaluable. Some people are great in analogies, some great people are you know, just have a good practical chush. I mean, everybody has different talents. Some people are great in halacha l'maisa, some people are great in lachas. So having a wide exposure is a good thing. But for reasons that we discussed, I think the only way that you really develop maximally, optimally, is by developing, you know, a focused methodology and an instinct. And that requires, I think, many years, and it needs a primary or predominant exposure and influence by a certain person or a certain derech. Like anything else, you know, if you're everywhere, if you're a jack of all trades, you're a master of none. And if you're running every year to a different derech, for most people, again, people's minds work in different ways. But for most people, it's a very bad educational strategy. I think that's what the Gemara means in the Avodah Zarah, basically. In Girsa, which I'm interpreting broadly to mean like a methodology, like how to read the Gemara, you know, what you think the Gemara is about, what its purpose is, what is it one text, is it many texts, you know, on the bigger issues, you know, where distraction is a distraction, so, and a negative, so then you want to have one ready. But when it comes to Svara, namely, when you want to fill in the gaps and try, you know, if you want to supplement it with other things, that's what makes each person unique. The fact that he isn't a clone, he's not meant to be a clone. He should have this strong self-image, self-perception of where he comes from, and it should be rooted in something strong. But at a certain point, when he has that foundation, and also coextensive with it, meaning, I'm not saying that you go to one Rebbe for 5 years and you don't look at anybody else, and then only, you know, once you've mastered the methodology and the personality, whatever, only then. I mean, for some people, maybe it would work better that way. For most people, you know, you're operating on two levels. Basically, you find a place, a person, a style which is intellectually and spiritually meaningful for you, and that becomes your foundation. And at the same time, you're getting exposure and picking up other things. So the combination, plus the combination of your own personality and proclivities, intellectual, spiritual, etc., you know, that's what creates chiddush. And sometimes it can be very dramatic. Without necessarily trying to, but just who you are and the sincere assimilation and internalization of the things that you've been exposed to, you know, can create that. Okay, and now back to, excuse me one second, I think my, now back to Mekalkel, or not back to Mekalkel, the beginning of Mekalkel. Just give me one second.